From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Berlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Tianwen Xu's short stories intimately draw the reader into the text, which can be hard to do for an author.
Because short story is like a race. You have to reach a certain kind of tension between content and format, like the tension on the surface of water.
This half hour, I'll talk with the winner of the University of Oklahoma's Newman Prize for Chinese Literature. But first, Rebecca Cruz joins me for a discussion about the problem of shipping hazardous material after that Chinese port explosion this week, and Amnesty International's announcement that they want to see the sex trade decriminalized.
They are arguing not necessarily a pro-prostitution stance, but they are a pro-workers' right, and they argue that they are being mistreated.
That's all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. Rebecca Cruz, lots of international news this week. Of course, big headline coming out of China, the massive explosion at a seaport in Tianjin in China, killing around 50 people, injuring hundreds, others still missing. I mean, the images of this were quite spectacular, really upsetting. But I mean, this was like had the equivalent of like 21 tons or more of explosives. But the seaport, this raises issues of bringing hazardous materials together in a place like a seaport where these materials are kind of coming and going by sea. But what do we know, I guess? I mean, I don't know that we know much yet about what's going on in China. But what we do know, and particularly given our background in studying seaports, is that this could happen anywhere.
It could. And this is a port where they are holding many of those materials. Obviously, different ports have different specialties, if you will, or different cargoes that they hold. And this is one that had a lot of hazardous materials. And once that started, it seemed to create a ripple effect where many other buildings kind of got in the crosshairs, if you will. And it sounded like fireworks going everywhere. They're still, as I understand it, still trying to contain this to some degree. The real issue is going to be some of these chemicals have obviously leaked. There's cyanide all over the ground. And so we have a death toll at this point, but trying to figure out what the long-term consequences are going to be for the citizens in the area. It's a very large area, as many seaports are in very large cities, obviously, because they employ a great many people. So seeing what those consequences are going to be, and then if there are environmental consequences as well to having this sort of chemical these chemicals around, as well as the fire and smoke that's been released.
Well, having visited a number of seaports in China myself in previous research projects that you and I were involved in, you know, the Chinese actually were quite good at and really touted their safety records at their seaports. And so it was very interesting to see this case, of course, disturbing. But it'll be interesting to see in the wake of this how regulations and other things might change regarding, again, the collection of hazardous materials in one place and what exactly happened here. But we'll be continuing to pay attention to that. Let's shift to the interesting vote this week from Amnesty International, international human rights organization, that voted to decriminalize the sex trade. Now, this seems to be surprising given Amnesty International's focus on international human rights. And of course, there was major opposition, many organizations and other human rights and other anti-trafficking organizations that came out very opposed to what Amnesty International said. But they seem to have an argument here. What is it?
Well, and first off, I do want to specify, they have voted to support this. They are by no means able to change the laws. They're obviously an organization that tries to put pressure on the international community. But they are arguing not necessarily a pro-prostitution stance, but they are a pro-workers' right. And they argue that this is a population of people often representing the lower socioeconomic groups, minority populations, indigenous populations around the world that are pulled into this or find themselves in this situation and that they are being mistreated. And so they are looking at this very much as a workers' rights situation. That is their argument.
Well, this relationship between law enforcement and prostitutes is a long-term one in terms of the police trying to crack down on this kind of activity. But what tends to happen is those trafficked into this business are treated very badly by the police, even though they are more or less sex slaves. Now, again, you and I know from our previous work on these issues, on trafficking issues, and particularly visiting former prostitutes in Italy, for example, that have been trafficked into the sex trade, that they really do struggle with being treated extremely poorly, not only by those who've gotten them into this situation, but by law enforcement.
Right. And so I think it also should be clear that Amnesty International is not obviously in favor of sex trafficking. But by decriminalizing this, they're saying that those that are trafficked, that they are not then in breach of a law, that it is the trafficker that is in breach of the law, not those people, which is another hold that the traffickers have on those people to say you've broken a law, so they may not then try to seek help or escape. But of course, those that are against this think that this is going to encourage more sex trafficking. And that line between being coerced into the sex industry and not being coerced is really, really unclear. And this will perhaps, some argue, make that even blurrier.
Well, and you look in cases where, you know, sex work is legal, you don't necessarily see any improvement when it comes to sex trafficking. So anyway, the jury's still out on this one, too. But a very interesting step and perhaps even bold step, some might say, by Amnesty International this week. OK, so then lastly, let's turn to Africa. I mean, in a year where we've had, you know, many years, I suppose, where we've had some negative news coming out of Africa, particularly on the health front, a year characterized by an Ebola outbreak, we actually have some very positive news. We recently just marked at 1 year since there's been a polio case anywhere on the continent of Africa. This is huge. This is one part of the world where we've not really been able to eradicate polio. And so we've at least made that year mark in Africa. So a global health success story here.
Absolutely a success story. Now, doctors are very cautious to say, you know, that this is something that we have to continue to put money into. We have to continue to monitor. They won't actually be polio-free for another 2 years. So there has to be a 3-year run. But this is very, very significant. And hopefully marking this will encourage those who have the resources and have the abilities to go and to continue to fight the struggle. Because Africa tends to be the last place that we see these sorts of disease hold on. And this last case that they had a year ago was in Nigeria, which had a serious situation with polio these last 10 years. So a big success story, though a cautious success.
Well, there's a resurgence in Nigeria of polio starting in around 2003. That was quite dramatic. But if you look at the overall statistics, it's just absolutely remarkable what has happened around the world with polio in terms of the dramatic decline. And so good stuff happening in
Africa
on this issue.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Rebecca, as always, for being here on Worldviews.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or get in touch with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzak Werlot. Next, I'll talk with Taiwanese author Tianwen Chu about her 4-decade literary career. She won the University of Oklahoma's Newman Prize for Chinese Literature earlier this year. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Werlot. My guest today is Tianwen Chu. She was born into a prominent literary family in Taipei in 1956. She followed in her family's footsteps as she started her writing career in the mid-1970s. But her breakthrough came in the early 1990s with her short story anthology, Fin de Siècle Splendor. Its characters are selfish and materialistic, but the use of exotic language is a deeper allegory about Taiwan's relationship with China's mainland and the island nation's troubled history over the past 4 centuries. She won the 2015 Newman Prize for Chinese Literature that's awarded every 2 years by the University of Oklahoma's Institute for U.S.-China Issues. Tianwen Chu, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Tianwen, congratulations, first of all, on winning this year's Newman Prize. It's a wonderful thing. First female winner of the Newman Prize, so congratulations for that. And this festival here is celebrating the work that you have done, your literary work. And I'd like to begin talking about the short story nature of your work. Much of your work and the work that's being honored here at the Newman Prize is a collection of short stories. Mm. And it's been said that your work, your short stories, suck the reader into the text, and that this is something that isn't common among short stories because often they're very short, and so you look to novels, you know, to really immerse yourself. But tell us about your work in the genre of short stories and why. Why short stories have been the area that you've chosen to work in?
Because short story is like a race, short distance race. You have to reach a certain kind of tension between content and format. And this tension is like the tension on the surface of water. And this tension would suck the readers into the story and transform them in a way.
So you have to obviously introduce your characters and really tell that story in a very vibrant way. I mean, your answer was also very vibrant and eloquent. I could see why you would be a great short story artist because, you know, that period of time that you have with your character in order to make your point is so difficult and so short.
There is a contrast between human and the environment. And this kind of tension in short stories can only be reflected through one certain point, and this point might be a weak point, but still this tension must be built on this very tiny or even weak point.
This
weak point might be, for example, a person's failure or dilemma, because normally a story would not depict one person's success. So normally I, as a writer, would depict the failure or dilemma of a person to reflect the most possibilities of his being. So the key of writing short story is to unfold the infinite possibilities on the weak point or the weak pinpoint.
So as you're writing, then you're finding these infinite possibilities. In terms of solving the dilemma or addressing this failure, do you know when you go into writing the story what that conclusion will be if, as you said, there are infinite possibilities?
My short stories do not offer answers. Actually, most of the time, they just raise a question. And as to how to answer this question, I leave it to my readers. For me, my job is to raise a question. A good question actually already contains in itself at least 50% of the answer. And the question consciousness itself is very important because it contains my understanding of the question.
I'm speaking with Taiwanese author Tianwen Chu, who's the fourth recipient of the University of Oklahoma's Newman Prize for Chinese Literature. We'll talk more about the work that earned her the award, the short story collection Fin de Siècle Splendor, right after this short break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest is Tianwen Chu, a Taiwanese author who won the University of Oklahoma's Newman Prize for Chinese Literature earlier this year. When we left off, she told us why she's gravitated towards short stories, especially in her most successful work, Fin de Siècle Splendor. It's been said about this book that it bears the imprints of Taiwan's fraught linguistic past. Can you tell us a little bit about what what Taiwan's past, linguistic past, has been and why it has been fraught?
Taiwan got its name from the Dutch and the Portuguese. When they traveled through the world, they saw Taiwan and they called this place Beautiful Island. Formosa means beautiful island. And that's how Taiwan's early name was came into being. And then in the Qing Dynasty, the Chinese people drove the Dutch away from the island. And Taiwan was a part of China, had been a part of China. And then in 1895, the Qing government lost its war to the Japanese, and Taiwan was given to the Japanese people as a colony. And then the Japanese ruled Taiwan for 50 years. So Japanese became a part of language during this colonial history period. And then in 1945, the Nationalist Party fought with the Chinese Communist Party, and then it lost its war. So since 1949, Taiwan was under the rule of the Nationalist Party. And so during this period, Mandarin became the official language of Taiwan. So over this historical period, Taiwan obviously had different, you know, linguistic elements. For example, the Dutch, the Portuguese, and the Qing Dynasty classical language, and then the Mandarin and Japanese before the Mandarin. So these five linguistic elements, they contribute to the fraught linguistic history of Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
other than these five languages, the native Taiwanese people, they also speak a language. And also the Cantonese people who came to Taiwan, they also speak their language.
So, 还有客家人。
There's also another linguistic element, which is a 客家 dialect, also
Hakka
dialect in Taiwan.
所以至少这七种算
So most of Taiwanese people now speak Taiwanese and also the Hakka dialect, but the official language is Mandarin.
基本上官方语言就是 Mandarin.
So it's basically your work is reflecting how language in Taiwan has reflected its colonial and past and historically combining all of these different colonial influences as well as the impact of native and dialect, local dialect. But today, I mean, do you still see a lot of difference? And I know one of the things that's really interesting about language in China and Taiwan and other parts of Asia is that it's very reflective of one's culture. Mm. And so is this how you can maybe come to terms with the fact that the cultural impact of colonial presence and as well as, you know, other local and native cultural impacts on a language as it's spoken today. Can you still detect all of that in the language today?
Actually, the language that is influencing Taiwanese people most is still Japanese. For example, my parents' generation, they almost all of them spoke Japanese. And when you speak a language, it's not about the language only, it's also about the culture behind the language. So that's why, like in their daily lives, they incorporated the cultural elements of the language. And this also contribute to the tension between the native Taiwanese people and the mainlanders who came from mainland China, because they have cultural clashes. The people who speak Japanese, they would recognize or identify with the Japanese culture, but the people who speak Mandarin, they do otherwise. They identify with the mainland Chinese culture. So that's why there's a tension between different groups of people in Taiwan.
非常充分地在生活细节里表现。
So it sounds like even though Taiwan is a small place, it's a small island, but that it's had a lot of influence, and still a lot of diversity even among its people, a lot of diversity in terms of the cultural representations and impact.
Diversity, in my opinion, actually it's a form of wealth. It's like the bank of the river. The soil is rich, so people can write.
对，对我们写作的就是。
So this soil on the bottom of the river is what we writers take from when we write.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tianwen, I'd like to talk about a couple of your other pieces of work, and particularly Notes of a Desolate Man and A City of Sadness, which deal with very difficult subjects, both at the individual and societal level. In Notes of a Desolate Man, you take on this subject of homosexuality in Taiwan, and the narrator talks about his friends that are dealing with you know, the struggles of living in society in Taiwan as a gay man, and of course then dying from AIDS. And where in A City of Sadness, you reflect on the white terror period, where it, back in the 1940s to 1987, where, you know, many people died. It was a period of martial law. It was very difficult. And so you've taken on some difficult kind of individual and societal issues in Taiwan as well. What led you to focus on these kinds of things? And maybe it goes back to kind of raising questions as opposed to providing answers. Mm-hmm. But what kinds of questions are you asking, or are you trying to communicate about dealing with these types of issues in Taiwan?
Some of the reasons of writing the Notes of Desolate Man, actually, it's a pure coincidence. For example, I had a friend, a teenager friend, who talked to me about his problems during a certain period of time, and I heard about his story, and I wrote about it. But as soon as I started writing about his story, I found that this element is amazing, because it's like I'm putting this different element in the bottle and also adding to this bottle other chemical elements, and then they interact with each other, and they create more tension, which I need for writing great piece of literature. So this is why I use that reason.
And the protagonist of the Notes of the Desolated Man is one homosexual who did not come out of the closet. It's precisely because he did not come out, so he creates more tension. He's carrying more tension than these people who are already the homosexual activists.
总之他对我来讲是一个新的状况,
he creates a new condition that even challenges all my past thoughts and stimulate me to write them out.
那至于像悲情城市的话,
so the story behind my writing A City of Sadness was the lifting of martial law in Taiwan in 1987. Actually, people had been talking about the martial law since as early as 1960s. And there were a lot of, for example, literary stories writing about this white terror, and they were not censored. But A City of Sadness was the first movie to deal with this problem. And I was like riding a big tide of people talking about the lifting, the white terror after the lifting of the martial law at that period. And as soon as the martial law was lifted, people naturally wanted to talk about it. So it's like the repressed energy in the mass was suddenly, all of a sudden, liberated. And I was riding that tide and wrote that story for the movie.
1987,对。所以当时这部电影在放映的，其实很多。
So even the generation like my parents' generation, they were not usually the movie goers, but A City of Sadness became a movie for which they can watch and think about their repressed history. So even these people, they would go to the movie to watch that film. That is why the box office of A City of Sadness was surprisingly good.
All right, well, Tianwen, thank you so much for being with us today. And again, congratulations on winning this year's Newman Prize in Chinese Literature. Your work sounds fascinating, and we're really pleased to hear from you about it. Thank you.
Yes. 好,谢谢.
You've been listening to my conversation with Tianwen Chu. The Taiwanese author won the University of Oklahoma's 2015 Newman Prize for Chinese Literature. You can watch her deliver her acceptance speech in Mandarin and see an English translation as well on our website, kgou.org. This conversation was translated by Ping Zhu, an assistant professor of Chinese and Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Oklahoma. She also serves as the deputy editor of the magazine Chinese Literature Today. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside OU's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre prepared the research for this interview, and the show was produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.